Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. Today, I have the pleasure of talking with Ginny Garrard-Burnett, author of a new study of Guatemala under Efrain Rios-Montt, titled Terror in the Land of the Holy Spirit, published by Oxford University Press. Of all the regions and case studies we've examined in this podcast, I'm probably least familiar with Guatemala and with Rios-Montt. So I'm sitting in my office, in my chair, and we've all had a book like this, and I found myself repeatedly putting the book down, getting up, and walking down the hallway to tell my colleagues some new insight or information or just something that I found fascinating out of the book. It's a short book, but it's packed with information and understanding, and it's going to stick with me at least for a long time. So I'm thrilled to get a chance today to unpack the insights with the author. So Ginny, let me say thank you for being with us and welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much, Kelly, and thank you for your kind words about the book. That actually was one of my objectives, to sort of open up the Guatemalan case to people who didn't know anything about Guatemala or its contemporary history. So I'm glad at least on that level it's successful.
So let's start out by just asking you to tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became interested in Guatemala.
Well, I became interested in Guatemala really by accident. I'm afraid to give away my own age here, but I was in graduate school in the early 1980s and had originally, I knew I was interested in Latin America. I thought I was interested in Mexico, but I had an opportunity to go to Guatemala instead of Mexico for a summer program in 1980. And unbeknownst to me, there was a civil war raging in Guatemala in 1980. And we arrived down there, and it was in some ways the beginning of the period I discuss here as La Violencia, the violence. Guatemala's civil war lasted 36 years, but there were ebbs and flows of it. And this is probably the period of time really from about 1978 to 1983, that's the real nadir of it. It's when probably 40% of the people were killed. And when I say the people, I mean civilians who were killed by the government. So it was a complete surprise to me to get there and to find this situation and to realize that even to go into Guatemala City, one ran the risk of not coming back. That at that time, there were people who would ride up to other people on motorcycles and shoot them on the street. There were ads in the paper every day about people who had lost loved ones, and they would post pictures of them and descriptions of a person who had been disappeared. There was nothing actually covered in the paper about the violence that was going on in the countryside, but the interlinear reading was profound. So I was there for a summer in 1980. Couldn't go back for a couple of years because by that time the war was really in full flower, the Army's counterinsurgency campaign against the guerrillas and by extension the large part of the civilian population. And then I went back in 1983, which is during the Rios-Montt era, and could see some real dramatic changes. By the time I got there in the summer of 1983, the Guatemalan army had pretty much defeated the guerrillas. And the evidence of what had happened in the interim was everywhere. There were fields burned out, lots of government propaganda everywhere, emaciated people, towns, villages gone. And so I was, by that time, researching my doctoral dissertation, which was about Protestantism in Guatemala, inspired in part by the fact that Rios Montt was a Pentecostal, although the direction that that dissertation in my first book went took a rather different direction than I originally thought on that question. But it continued to nag at me all these years that I felt like there was something I needed to do for my own soul self to write about this period of time. On the other hand, there's been a lot of discussion, I think correctly, in Guatemala about who owns the history. And since the end of the war in 1996, Guatemala continues to be a very violent place, but in a different sort of way than it was during the war. There's been a lot of discussion about what does it mean to reconcile with history, to uncover what happened during that period of time, who did what to whom. And it seemed important to me that this be a question that was really sorted out by Guatemalans, to give them their own agency and their own, you know, to put them at the front of the story and not foreigners who come in on a white horse to sort of show them what happened. I think there's really a little bit too much of that in my field. But I was talking about this kind of, I really sort of saw it as a moral dilemma as well as a professional one about what to do about this story that I wanted to tell, that I felt like was important to be told, but that didn't seem to me that maybe I was the right person to do it. It was actually some Guatemalans who said no. They said, you know, we can't tell this story yet. And so we need other people to do it as long as you recognize our position in this. And so that's what finally, I suppose, gave me permission to go ahead and write this book. With the understanding that other people will come back later and maybe do a different job, maybe a better job than I've done. But for now, I think this is what we have.
So let's start out. Why don't you introduce us to Rios Montt? Where did he grow up? What kind of formative influences did he have? How did he imagine his life was going to be like?
What a good question. He is from a prominent French Guatemalan family. That's where the Montt comes from. I say prominent. He's not from an elite family. He's from an aspirant family. He's from not Guatemala City. He's from the Quetzaltenango area, which is the second largest city, but much, much, much smaller than Guatemala City. And he's not from the city itself. It was a family that had a very strong work ethic, a real emphasis on achievement. They had, I'm not sure, I think maybe four or five children. Some of them died as children, but he and his brother Mario Rios Montt are certainly, by, I suppose, a lot of measures, the success of the family. Rios Montt became a general, and his brother Mario is currently Archbishop of Guatemala. And so in Guatemala, certainly for people who aren't born into wealthy families, those are actually the two avenues to success, for people who are sort of working up a meritocracy, the military and the church. And so both of the brothers made it to the top of their fields in that way. Beyond that, though, he, attended the Polytechnic Institute. He attended the predecessor of the School of the Americas. He, for most of his career, had a fairly conventional Guatemalan military career. I mean, it was not extraordinary in any particular way, although he continued to move up the military hierarchy. But in 1976, he ran for president as a Christian Democrat, meaning as a Roman Catholic, and was seen as a reformist character, a reformist politician who was opposed by fellow army officers under the concern that he wouldn't be hard enough on communism, which is really kind of an interesting thing to have happened. And so he won the election, but he was defrauded out of it, and so was sent into diplomatic exile to Spain so that he would not, contest the fact that he had been, you know, sort of the elections had been stolen from him. And while he this sort of threw him into a period of self-reflection and I suppose some self-doubt, because it also meant that his military career was stymied as well. And while sort of in this period of self-doubt, he became a born-again Christian and a Pentecostal Christian. 1976 is a year, a huge year in Guatemala, because in February of that year, February 4th of 1976, there was a massive earthquake that struck the country. And the epicenter of it was very near Guatemala City. And, you know, earthquakes, like many natural disasters, but somehow it seems like in Central America, uniquely earthquakes, really throw the fault lines that the country's already in into high relief. Mm-hmm. And so you'd already had this civil war going on between leftist guerrillas and military counterinsurgency in the 60s. It had almost been, the left had almost been defeated in about 1969. But they were regrouping in the mid-1970s, and with the earthquake, it gave them an impetus that they had not had prior to that time. It also gave the military a reason to really begin to clamp down on the dissent in a way they probably hadn't done in maybe 5, 6, 7 years. You know, to sort of contextualize things, by the late 1970s, of course, that's when the Sandinistas are very close to gaining power in Nicaragua, 1979, July 1979. It's also a period of time when the FMLN in El Salvador seems to be poised on the edge of victory as well. And so the Guatemalan guerrillas were not necessarily affiliated with either of those two groups. But on the other hand, they had common goals with them and certainly were inspired by what had happened elsewhere in Central America. And by 1980, by the time I got there in 1980, they had gained a lot of ground. And the military was in kind of a moral panic about it. In January of 1980, a group of campesinos, you know, peasant organizers occupied the Spanish embassy, just demanding their rights to land and sort of rights as citizens. And the Guatemalan government burned the Spanish embassy with everybody in it, including including Spanish diplomats and a couple of reporters who were there. It was a horrific event. Jean Franco, who's sort of a she actually does literary criticism, but she sort of thinks in bigger terms than that. She talks about the burning of the Spanish embassy is one of the most profound acts of disrespect the Guatemalan military could have perpetrated against the Guatemalan people. And in fact, the burning of the Spanish embassy in January 1980 sort of marks the beginning of the true resurgence of the left, when they begin to really gain serious support. The alienation of people who had maybe tried to remain neutral on the question, and a strong reaction on the part of the government. And so that's why in some ways you could see 1980 as the true beginning of La Violencia. The next year there was a presidential election, which of course was supposed to bring a military leader into power, and did elect someone. But then there was in March of 1982, there's a coup on the part of a group of dissident military leaders with strong support from most of the military, which is led by Rios Montt and two other generals. And that's the coup that brings him to power. The idea was that there had been too much corruption in the military, that the military was being very ineffective, that they had been using a lot of kind of random terror and violence to bring the country under control, which wasn't working very well, and that you needed a more concerted, systematic plan of how to sort of rein in all this massive opposition that was springing up all over the country. And Rios Montt, from a military point of view, is the one that does it. You know, he has at the time he's the golpista, he's a member of this coup. I'm not at all convinced that his fellow military officers, certainly not the U.S. Embassy, had a full understanding of how his thinking had changed since earlier in his career, since he had been a Christian Democratic you know, presidential candidate. He had this religious conversion, and he, you know, he had never really in any formal way articulated what his idea of a new Guatemala would be. But that, in fact, that's what he tries to put into effect, this thing he calls the new Guatemala, which involves first defeating the left decisively, and secondly, sort of recreating a new Guatemala as a sort of utopian city on the hill, which that part never really happens.
Let's take those one at a time. So how does his attempt to defeat the left differ from his predecessors?
Well, it's an interesting thing, and it's one of those things I think history's really good at being able to sort of use the historical lens to see how that happened. It was not all that clear at the time, and in fact, the way people understood the way it worked at the time, this is, to me, is really interesting, because one of the things I try to look at in my book is how people understand terror and how they understand authoritarianism at the time that it's going on versus how they understand it later. Under Lucas Garcia, who's Rismont's predecessor, Romeo Lucas Garcia, also a general, you see the military government reacting to dissent with a kind of randomized terror. That is, you see a lot of disappearances, a lot of political kidnappings, a lot of corpses that show up on the streets of Guatemala City early in the morning, disfigured and maimed. You see them taking actions against people in the countryside, but not in a particularly predictable way. And so if one of the objectives of terror is to keep people controlled through just not being able to predict what's going to happen, just, you know, mind your own business and don't try anything, that's effective. But in fact, people, it didn't seem to be effective in this setting. And so people did continue to organize into, you know, from just being maybe health promoters or teachers all the way to carrying arms against the government, you know, attempting to overthrow it. I mean, what I'm calling dissent is a very wide range of behaviors and attitudes toward the government. But from Lucas's point of view, it was all something that threatened the government. And so it all had to be somehow dealt with. And yet there wasn't a system for doing it in a particularly practical way. Under Rios Montt had a much clearer idea of what needed to be done from a military point of view. And then I'm going to, you know, talk about this from his point of view, because this is one of the things I tried to sort of understand. One of the paradoxes of the Rios Montt era that's being forgotten now, but at the time he had a lot of support. And in fact, he remained a very popular political figure in Guatemala for 20 years after his term in government. He was only in power 18 months and was a perennial presidential candidate, forbidden to actually run for president by the Constitution. And yet people time and time again would bring him up for this. And in fact, even today, he has certain sectors of support, but perhaps from a more predictable kind of, you know, business, military, security sector than in this earlier post-Rios Montt era, where even people in the conflict zones, even people in the massacre zone supported him. And so one of my questions was, why? You know, how can that be? Well, I think that goes back to exactly this question. What was his plan? So his plan was, number one, to rein in random terror from Guatemala City. The night of the coup, he said, I don't want to see any more corpses in the street. And they stopped. When I was in Guatemala in 1980, and certainly 1980, 81, 80, early 82, the firemen would go through the streets of Guatemala City at dawn every morning and pick up bodies that had been thrown out in the night. And Rios Montt said, I don't want to see any more of that. And with those words, it stopped, meaning that the people who were doing it were listening to him. he also, and this certainly had a lot to do with his ideas of being a born-again Christian, I think. Mm-hmm. He was an ardent advocate of anti-corruption campaigns. And he meant it at this point. He made every government official take a vow. There was a sort of a three-fingered salute that you saw everywhere, and everybody actually held it up the thumb and the first two fingers. No robo, no miento, no abuso, which is I don't rob, I don't lie, I don't steal. And if he caught anybody doing any of those three things, they would lose their jobs or be very seriously sanctioned for it. That included his fellow military officers. It included all government officials. And in a place like Guatemala, historically, that's a reason you would be a government official, so that you could lie and steal and rob, right? It certainly the people around him began to think this is not what we had in mind, but it made him very popular in urban areas where people, you know, were subject to petty graft and corruption all the time. But they liked that about him. One of the things that he did that people still remember very ardently, very strongly, is that he would go on TV every Sunday night. He would wear civilian clothes. He'd have a candelabra behind him or a flag or something like that. And he would talk about edifying moral topics. And sometimes they were expressly political. He would talk about how the guerrillas were disrespectful, and if they'd had proper respect for authority, if they had had good fathers, they would have never joined these disrespectful groups that were trying to overthrow the government, but the government hadn't been respectful to the people, and so the children should be submissive to their fathers, but their fathers should be respectful to their families, and women should submit themselves to their husbands, but on the other hand, the husband should not abuse the wife in any way. And just like you have a family in this sort of biblical model, society should correspond to that too. So you have this, ideally in his mind, you have this very paternalistic but benevolent government that is almost like a simulacrum of God in his relationship with his people, right? And Rios Montt's idea was if you could get everybody to behave this way, we wouldn't have these kinds of problems, right? Not just violence, but even in a couple of his Sunday sermons, as people call them, they weren't sermons, they were actually called Sunday discourses. he actually says, you know, you also wouldn't have the problems of gross inequalities and greed that have created some of these difficulties. Anyway, he never goes so far as to say the guerrillas are justified in trying to fight for a new society, but he does sort of intimate that there's enough blame to go around. And of course, people watch these every Sunday. It was actually really interesting to me when my book was published in Spanish this summer, and I had kept on a separate file, I had kept all the Rios Montt discursos in Spanish with the idea that it would be translated. But in the book, they're out in English, of course. But the translator had gone through and had already translated him. He had to go back and substitute him. But he said what kind of scared him, he'd been a little boy when Rios Montt was in power. But, of course, his family always watched it. And he said it must have been like an earwig in his head, because he was really surprised at how he'd gotten the cadence and the words. Mm-hmm. And he said it's really a little bit scary. But anyway, I want to return to what his program was, because I haven't even discussed the most important part. The most important part was at the time that Rios Montt took power, and there's a debate in this in Guatemala to this day, for some specific reasons we might have time to talk about. But the debate is over how likely was it that the guerrillas would successfully be able to take over the country. At the time, there's this sort of a little bit of a forked tongue on the part of the government, because the government's rhetoric about the guerrillas was that they were very effective, poorly armed, poorly organized, sort of a Keystone Cop group of guerrillas, so not really a threat to the government. But on the other hand, you need a total war against them.
Yeah.
And so, one could say that doesn't really add up. It's either one way or the other. I think certainly in the post-war period, we get a very strong sense that the guerrillas had, at least at certain moments, many more supporters than, in Guatemala City had understood that to be at the time. But on the other hand, you have to be careful that doesn't lead to, in my mind, that it doesn't lead to a justification of what the government did. And so it's, but certainly by the way they defined who the guerrillas were, they took the sort of the classic Régis Debray sort of French approach that the guerrillas swim like a fish in the ocean. You have to drain the entire ocean. And they certainly did that. Now, one of the things that distinguishes the sort of modern left from the 1960s left is in the 1960s, the left was pretty much organized in the city, and they were labor unionists and students and, you know, well-read, you know, well-informed, Cuban-trained, sometimes Marxist leaders. By the 1970s, they changed their strategy to go into the countryside, particularly in the predominantly Maya highlands, Maya indigenous highlands, because of the, I think, their correct understanding that the most egregious poverty and the most unequal distribution of resources were among the Maya population, who have suffered from prejudice and you know, being left out of, either left out or subjugated by national development plans since as long as there's been a Guatemala, a nation of Guatemala. You know, one of the things about it is that the left, there was an umbrella organization called the URNG, but the largest of the guerrilla organizations was the Guerrilla Army of the Poor, the EGP. One of the things that they really had to grapple with was how much do you want to make this a sort of an ethnic-based struggle. Most of them were Ladinos, meaning non-Maya. Most of them were urban people who'd grown up in the cities. A lot of them were, you know, had sort of been formed in the university. But they were also conventional Marxists who think about, you know, the contradictions of society in terms of class, not in terms of race and ethnicity. And so it was a real challenge for them to sort of figure out how do we do this? And how do we do this by incorporating Maya into the revolution, but without putting them in particular harm's way? Because one of the pernicious effects of racism, of course, is that when people who, you know, when it's people of color who are involved, very often, if they've already been prejudiced against, there's an automatic suspicion against them, and retribution is more likely to fall on them. And in fact, that's exactly what happened in this case. The Maya were not, I'm speaking as if they're all one person. I don't mean to do that. There are lots of factions and communities and leaders and, you know, I don't mean to be disrespectful that way. But, you know, and they have their own understanding of history. And, you know, they were not particularly open to what the guerrillas had to offer initially because they understood that it might put them in harm's way, and also might not particularly have anything to offer to them that other non-Maya options had to offer. But eventually, particularly through certain organizations within the Catholic Church, which the Maya were very much involved with, they did see that provided them some options. And so by the time Rios Montt was in power, he and his advisors decided that the thing to do would be to offer what he called fusiles y frijoles, which is, fusiles is rifles and frijoles are guns, beans and bullets is the way a lot of people call it in English, which was pretty much a carrot and stick. That is, we offer you amnesty. We offer you to give up your affiliation as we understand it. And an affiliation could, with the guerrillas, could range from, you know, carrying arms and marching through the mountains and the jungle and taking part in confrontations with the Guatemalan army, all the way to, you know, bringing them beans and tortillas. You know, so it didn't take much to be accused of affiliating with them. So anyway, the Fusiles y Frijoles starts in what we would call, their seasons are different there, but what we would call summer of 1982. And it ends up being a scorched earth campaign in the highlands. That is, they went through, and my understanding of this is sort of an, I don't know if it's an apocryphal story, but I tend to believe it, that they actually went through with a map and they had push pins, this being 1982. And red ones for ones that were for villages that were affiliated with the guerrillas, green for ones that were not, and yellow for ones that maybe, maybe not, with the instructions to go in there and clean up all the red and yellow villages. Well, the military did go into these villages, and particularly in July of 82, you see a large number of confrontations between the Guatemalan government and Mayan villages, and in any number of cases, massacres in the villages by the military. And so it's a horrific time. This is when certainly the United Nations Truth Commission report that came out in 1999 notes that this is when the Guatemalan government identified the Maya people as internal enemies of the state, which it, to me, there's not a single moment when that happens. But in fact, in my mind, in my understanding of it, it's a combination of racism and political exigencies that make that happen. One of the, I haven't even mentioned this, some of your listeners might know that Rios Montt actually was tried for human rights abuses and genocide last spring and convicted of both of them. And the point of genocide was a crucial one. And he, as I said, there were two charges against him. One was crimes against humanity. The other one was genocide. And this remains a pivotal question. It was actually, it was one Maya group, the Ixchel Maya group, that they brought the genocide charges. There are 22 different Maya language groups, the Ixcheles being just one of them. But that was the case that they brought. I should also mention that despite the fact he was convicted and sentenced to 80 years in prison, and he's in his mid-80s now, so that's the rest of his life, really. Right. He's also been let off at this point. If you go to Guatemala today, you'll see that different groups have campaigns and buses with their sides painted with this and billboards that will say genocidio, which means was there a genocide? Was there or was there not genocide? And so, you know, the question of whether or not this was actually genocide or just kind of looked like genocide has loomed very, very large in Guatemala and continues to today. And I will say in my book, I actually, the book came out before the trial. I'm not even sure I would have taken it on, this question on, had it not. But in my book, genocide, you write it, this program is about genocide and your listeners are going to know a lot about it. And it has a very specific definition. And so one can raise a question whether or not by that very specific definition, what happened in Guatemala was or wasn't genocide. But in the book, I make the case that there's, you have the sort of matrices of genocide and then you have the matrices of what happened. And there's so much overlap. I think of it as kind of a Venn diagram that when you come out on the other side of it, unless you have a legal case, which you actually do end up with in Guatemala, it's sort of, I hate to say it this way, but it sort of doesn't matter. You have thousands and thousands of people who are killed for who they are. And so whether or not it fits that very precise, Nuremberg era definition or not, unless you're in a specific legal situation, I think it doesn't matter too much. Now, I have colleagues who disagree with that.
Yeah.
And you don't have to be a, you know, as they'd say there, a Rios Montista to take a different view of it. but, you know, there we are.
Well, I know your schedule is tight. And so here I'll just refer the our listeners. I think one of the most interesting parts of this book is the way in which you talk about symbols and about lenses and about how you question the kind of binary interpretations of whether this is a Cold War conflict between capitalists and communists, or whether this is a Protestant / Pentecostal versus Catholic conflict, to what degree it's a political civil war as opposed to a genocide, and suggest to the readers that, or to the listeners, that it's well worth reading to get Jenny's thoughts about that. But as I say, I know your time is tight. Really quickly, you said he was only in power for a year and a half.
Yeah.
What happened?
Oh, he's overthrown in a coup. He was overthrown in a coup in August of 1983. And the reason that he was overthrown in the coup, I think, is twofold. Number one, he had accomplished what the military wanted him to accomplish. That is, by August 1983, the guerrillas were not defeated, but they had really been reduced, and much of the support for them had been reduced, largely because people were terrified. The other thing is his anti-corruption campaign, which absolutely infuriated his fellow military officers and other people in the government and people in the businessmen's organization, because he took that seriously. In fact, my husband's a radio reporter, in fact, and when he covered this coup. And
oh wow,
yeah, well, it was actually his first day out of Spanish school, which is sort of a terrifying specter, isn't it? But the story was at the time that as Rios Montt was being led out of the National Palace, you know, this slogan, "I don't rob, I don't lie, I don't steal," one of the coup leaders said to him, "The government that doesn't steal doesn't govern." And he was you know, very idiosyncratic. Some would not even use as kind of word as that. And he was a loose cannon. And so I think the military and the civilians behind the military wanted someone that they felt like was more predictable than Rios Montt was. It certainly wasn't because people opposed what had happened with Fusilis y Frijoles. To the contrary, I think they felt like that had been successful. And in fact, in Argentina, I've heard that the military referred to Rios Montt's program as the Guatemalan solution.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, you know, that's why he was overthrown. But he felt like it was sort of unfinished business. And in fact, his daughter, Zuri Rios Montt, is a prominent a legislator in Guatemala today. And she is an ardent defender of her father. Some feel that perhaps one of the reasons why Rios Montt's case has not been dismissed, but it's, I think what his lawyers have been able to do is to set up a situation, since he is in his 80s, that they'll basically run out the clock on his trial.
Yeah.
He'll never serve any more time. He served 10 days in jail, and that was it. That it isn't actually his supporters so strongly as her supporters. So it's possible. She certainly, I had the opportunity to attend one day of his trial, and she was certainly there in force, giving interviews and taking pictures of the people who were there. And certainly we haven't heard the last of the Rios Montt family.
Well, it's an amazing story, and you tell it really well. And as
thank
I say, I encourage the readers or the listeners to go get a copy of the book. It's far richer than we've had a chance to deal with here. So let me just conclude by asking what's kind of our usual final question, and that's, what are you working on next?
Oh, well, thank you for asking. I'm actually really excited about this. It's in an early phase, but I'm working on a project about revolutionary priests in Central America in the 80s, mainly American priests, and trying to develop an understanding of how they got to the point where they became revolutionaries. Because most of them went down to Central America with an idea that they were going to work in development projects, that they were going to sort of work in tandem with USAID, that would be the way they would put the ideas of the Second Vatican Council and the Medellin conference into effect. And some of them do that, and others of them get there and see a reality that's very different than they expected, and over time adopt a genuinely revolutionary position, which puts them at odds with the U.S. government. And so there are a lot of really interesting sources about that. So you have, you know, U.S. embassies in places like Guatemala and El Salvador and Nicaragua who are supposed to defend the interests of U.S. citizens, but they find themselves, that, you know, in this position where U.S. citizens, these clergy, are opposed to the interests of the U.S. government. And so not very far along on this project, but very excited. And I'd really like to get on it soon because a lot of them are still alive. But even since I've conceptualized the project, three people that I wanted to interview have died. So time to get on it.
Well, it sounds like a great project, and I hope when it's done, you'll join us again.
Well, thank you so much, Kelly.
But for now, thanks so much for being with us, and I hope you have a great day.
Well, thank you. You too. And thank you for your interest.
You've been listening to an interview with Virginia Garrard Burnett, author of the new book, Terror in the Land of the Holy Spirit, Guatemala under General Efrain Rios Montt, 1982-1983, published by Oxford University Press. If you enjoyed this interview, you can listen to previous podcasts through iTunes or from the webpage for New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. I hope you'll come back next time for the first of a two-part series on Raphael Lemkin. Later in the month, I'll post an interview with Donna Lee Fries about Lemkin's autobiography, Totally Unofficial, which she edited, as well as a special issue of the Journal of Genocide Research devoted to Lemkin. Next, however, is an interview with Steve Jacobs, who has edited Lemkin's unpublished History of Genocide. I hope you'll join us then for a fascinating discussion of the book, which Jacobs has titled Lemkin on Genocide. Until then, have a great month.